When Bart Stupak originally ran for Congress in 1992, one promise he made was to work toward a national health care program. 19 years later, President Barack Obama signed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. But that legislation would not have passed had the president not promised Congressman Stupak an executive order forbidding the use of federal tax dollars to pay for abortions. The complex story behind the Stupak-Pitts Amendment and passage of the health care law is detailed in a book written by Stupak entitled For All Americans. We'll talk about it with the author himself just ahead on Media Meet. And welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guest is former 9-term Upper Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak. Joining me on the panel is Great Lakes Radio News Director Walt Lindelof. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, some brief background. You were born in Milwaukee and grew up in the Escanaba-Gladstone area.
Yes.
You were the middle child of a large Catholic family that instilled a strong sense of responsibility, service, and social justice. Your early career was in law enforcement, where a developing commitment to national health care was fueled by some health issues of your own. It was an injury incurred in the line of duty, is that correct?
Correct.
How did that inform your position on health care?
Well, back then I was injured in line of duty, and by the time I left the state police, I got injured in 82. I left in February of 84. By then I had 6 operations on my knee, and I never had to worry about the cost of health care. Mm-hmm. It was paid for. Not only did I have good insurance through the Michigan State Police, but also it was a workers' compensation injury. I was chasing a person and blew out my knee.
Okay.
And so therefore, I never worried about it. And then when I went into the state legislature, they assured me that their fine legislative health care plan would cover my pre-existing injury until my first operation. And then they said, nope. But I was in that window where I could go back on my old insurance. It was right after. It was like January of 1989, because I'd just come off the campaign. My knee was really bad, so they had to get in their operation.
I see.
So anyways, long story short, even all the promises they made, when it came right down to it, so-called we cover pre-existing injuries, depends on how much that surgery costs. That's really what it came down to. So okay. I had to go back. But anyways, that's where it started building. And then the legislature, we tried to end the practice of balance billing to seniors on Medicare and Medicaid.
I see.
We lost that by one vote. There's a lot of things that happened through that period of time that built up about, first of all, I always thought healthcare, everybody had it.
Yeah.
And I never worried about it because I had good health insurance. But then you get out and you start working and you start realizing people really do have difficulties.
And you could have been caught in that on the issue of previous conditions, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so when I went to Congress after I won in 93, they assured me this Cadillac plan that legislators had there in Congress would take care of everything. Don't worry about it. I didn't trust them. I never took the federal health insurance.
Okay.
I stayed with my state police.
Really?
Was the other one better? Probably. But I wasn't going to trust it again. And since then, I've had several more operations, not just on my knee, but also my back. So, I mean, they're all been covered, 90, 10, 80, 20, whatever it might have been. It still cost me money out of pocket for those out of pocket expenses, or balance billing, as we call it. But anyways, I'm happy with I did not take the federal health insurance. And I could look at it more objectively, I believe, that way.
Okay. You made 3 promises when you ran for Congress in 1992. One was pledging to work toward a health care program for all Americans, hence the title of your book. An increase in the minimum wage and fiscal responsibility in Washington.
Correct.
How'd you do?
3 for 3.
3 for 3.
Took 18 years, but 3 for 3. I mean, President Clinton came in and we did the deficit reduction package in 93, which was a very controversial vote. But by the time his term, 98, 99, we were running budget surpluses.
Okay.
So we did get our fiscal health in order.
Good.
The minimum wage was raised in 93, and it was again by about 90, around 2000 was raised again. So it's been raised at least twice when I was in Congress.
Okay.
I believe it should be raised again. And of course, we got health care at the end. So all Americans have access to health care.
Right. The health care processes, you started to get involved with this. I mean, you were involved right off the start, but as it started to become something under President Obama, you really got in the mix. You really got in there. Tell us a little bit about that experience, how it was as you got more involved.
Sure, I really got involved. I was on the Energy and Commerce Committee for 16 years, my last 16 years.
Which is probably the most influential committee in
It is,
in
and
it
had the greatest jurisdiction over healthcare. Yeah. And I was chairman of the Oversight Investigation Subcommittee. So I did investigations into the insurance industry. How do they balance bill? How do they underinsure? What do they do with small businesses? And how rescissions, why do they kick people off their health insurance policies and the scandal that is? And when you do, and a patient bill of rights was developed through our committee,
right,
which a lot of it's in the Affordable Care Act. So our committee was always interested in healthcare, but wasn't until last 4 years, from 2007 to 2010, when Democrats were in charge, we could actually do the investigations. Investigations led to many parts of the Affordable Care Act, the ones that protect people. Right now, you have a standard minimum policy. You hear recently the Republicans, the Graham-Cassidy bill, give it back to the states. Sure, you can buy affordable health insurance, but it'll cover nothing. And where do you appeal when they kick you off unjustly? Like Robin Beaton, who I mentioned in the book, who had to have a double mastectomy, they denied her insurance policy because she had acne. Now, what does that have any relationship to breast cancer? Absolutely nothing. The women in this country who've been kicked off their insurance policies because a form of cancer, especially breast cancer, was amazing. And they paid tens of millions of dollars in fines when they were caught. Anthem Insurance and some others made no difference. They'll kick you off again. I had the CEOs on the book. I had the CEOs in front of our committee. I said, you can kick a person off for this. They said, yes. I said, turn the page over. Here's all the things you're going to exclude coverage for. What does this mean? I couldn't even pronounce a word. Mm-hmm. And they had no idea. So you're kicking people off, and you don't even know what the words mean.
So you're saying, as an educated person, you have a law degree, all of the things that you gained before you were in Congress, you're looking at policies, you're looking at insurance policies that has terminology in it that you and the people in charge of it don't even really know what it means.
Correct. The insurance companies have software programs that have between 1,400 to 2,000 terms. If you take your prescription, they put Walt in there and put a prescription in there, if that triggers one of those words, they go back, pull your policy, go through it, because it just triggered an expensive medical treatment.
Okay.
They're going to find any reason they can to kick you off, and they pay their employees a bonus to kick you off because we save money. It's called post-claims review. In other words, you sign up for your insurance policy, all they want, their monthly premium, you're covered, Walt, everything's fine. Soon as you submit a doctor bill or something, now they'll go back and look to see if you're even qualified for that policy. They do it after, post-claim underwriting, they call it.
Well, let's look at what it was like before and what it's like now, in a way. The Affordable Care Act was not casually named. It was, you noted in your book, you note the average health care policy was over $13,000, while median household income in the UP was less than $39,000. You point to a 2007 study that showed 62% of all bankruptcies were related to health care.
And 78% of those people had health insurance.
Oh,
so if you had such good health insurance, if 62% of all bankruptcies are because of health insurance and 78% of them had insurance, what's the quality or value of the health insurance?
Right.
Exactly what you paid for it. Nothing.
Well, a staggering number of people were dying simply for lack of health care. You mentioned that several times in the book. It must have occurred to you a lot. We're now 7 years down the road. While more people, especially low-income folks, are now covered, it seems that many who are paying for it are finding insurance unaffordable. What do you see happening? Is the program doomed to collapse of its own weight? That's been suggested.
Well, it's doomed to collapse because right after we passed the Affordable Care Act, the Republicans took over and they've starved the program.
Okay.
They have not provided the money to provide the stabilizations of these rates. Under the Accountable Care Organizations, they were promised 5 years to understand your demographics of your population you're insuring, and we would backstop you financially.
Okay.
And all that money's been cut. All that money's been cut. So you're still trying to comply with the law and receiving 50% of the money you should. Or to try to get people to sign up, it's a 90% cut.
Right.
So how does a program survive if you starve it to death? You know, the interesting thing, the Republicans, it's been a, you know, repeal, replace, political slogans.
Sure.
They don't understand the policy decisions. I was speaking the other day at a group, and I looked back. And in 2010, when we passed the Affordable Care Act, 62 or 63% of the House of Representatives were not even in office. There has not been an honest policy debate since we passed the Affordable Care Act in March of 2010. They really don't know what they're voting on. They're voting politics, not policy. Mm-hmm. Even President Trump, who was going to replace it with a much better, cheaper, better plan,
right,
had to admit it's really complex.
Sure.
It really is. It really is. So any Congress can repeal it, but let's repeal it on policy reasons, not politics.
Yeah, nobody is saying we should leave it the way it is necessarily.
No.
They're talking about stabilizing markets. What do you see as our best way out of the weeds toward a better system right now?
Well, everybody has to be part of it. I mean, right now, okay, they can't repeal it. So what they said, you know, in there, if you didn't have health insurance, you had to pay a percentage of your income. They said, don't worry about it. We're not going to enforce it. So, I mean, we all got to have some skin in the game. That
right.
policy you mentioned there of costing $13,000 per family, mm-hmm. over 1,000 of that policy just went to pay for the uninsured. So, I mean, you were always paying for the uninsured. So now when they go and when they have a bankruptcy, you talked about 62% of all those
right.
bankruptcies, who pays for that? We all do in higher prices. Look, we want the latest, greatest medical. If I get in an accident day, I want to make sure I get the best care. But who pays for that? And if I don't have to have insurance, you're all paying for it then. We're all in this together. It's a problem we have to address together.
Let's talk a little bit about the book specifically. You were involved in the process
yes.
of getting the amendments together to get Obamacare passed. When you originally did that, I remember you saying that maybe it was an impossible story, something to write, and then that kind of laid dormant for a while, and then you decided to actually write the book. Tell us the story a little bit about how you got from what happened to the book here on the table.
Sure, after the Affordable Care Act passed, one or two of my staff people said, you just got to write what happened to you in the last 15 months. It's really quite a story. So I went and saw an attorney who specializes in literary works and agencies and that. He said, you have no story. You're not known, you have no story, it's not important. Okay, so after I left Congress, I did a fellowship up at Harvard. There I outlined a book. I always had in the back of my mind I might write a book. Talked to a few people, no, there's no book, okay. The problem was I wasn't right and I wasn't left. Therefore, there's no audience. And even after I wrote the manuscript and shopped the manuscript around a couple of publishers, No, you're not right-leaning, you're not left-leaning enough. There's no story here. What really happened in 2015, I said, I went up to Harvard. Harvard came to me and said, we want to do a case study. It's always, ethics in government was always a death penalty. It's time to modernize it. Let's talk about the values and the ethical considerations you had in healthcare, because we've heard you speak about it when you were up here, we'd like to. They worked with me in spring of 2015. We put together a case study, which is now a required course. My study is in four different courses they teach at Harvard, the case study. And then BBC came to me that time, and they were doing the Obama years, a documentary on Obama. And part two was healthcare. And they said, if we want to know about healthcare, we've been told we should talk to you. So I explained it to them. They were fascinated by a story. They never do it, but they transcribed the interviews, sent them to me with a note saying, you must tell your story. It is absolutely remarkable. Plus, everything you say, you back it up with documentation. So I have the proof. And so with those two, Harvard and BBC, and watching people on TV embellish their role in healthcare, and they had no role, I decided it was time to set the story straight for history and for historical purposes,
now you,
not knowing where to go.
You're down to names and dates on these things. How was your process? How did that process work?
I'm a pack rat. I have all my notes.
I remember this brown folder you
brown
used
accordion,
to carry
yeah.
around, the brown accordion folder, which is mentioned in the book a couple of times. And it seemed like that was your companion every stop.
It was, and it got a little ratty at the end, but I kept it all.
And was that where some of the documentation was?
A lot of documentation mm-hmm. was there. I always had my staff write up my daily schedule on a little card I put in my shirt pocket, and I'd put my notes on there. When I was whipping members, I had my list of members. I'd put my notes on my little note cards. Yeah. The fact sheet, I didn't believe I said pack rat, that I sent the technical corrections bill to ROM trying to get this process moved along, I still had the fax cover sheet in my file.
Okay.
I mean, just stuff like that.
I kept it.
And I've great memory on some of these details, and I have notes to back it up.
So, and that kind of ties into it. Did you look at it more as a memoir or a document of this process? Because ultimately, the story really is that you went into this thing as a pro-life Democrat, where everyone else was pro-choice. That's where the entire amendment conversation, all of it came from. Were you looking at it as a memoir or a document of this process?
I think when I probably did the outline, it was probably a memoir. When I actually wrote the manuscript, it was more of a document, because 5 years had transpired and what people were saying was not true. So I had to show the documentation to show it's true, what really did happen. Mm-hmm. An example, Rahm Emanuel, who's the president's chief of staff, in a BBC article on healthcare, he says, you know, Bart Stupak and I sat right here in my office, across from one another, and one afternoon we worked it all out, and that's really good for two non-attorneys. Rahm was never in our room. I never negotiated with Rahm. And I've been an attorney for 38 years. But he was taking all the credit. Mm-hmm. And I've seen other people try to deny the commitment that the Right to Life Democrats made to get healthcare passed.
In which the leadership talked to you and said they refused to
even acknowledge that we had this
meeting.
Interview.
Yeah, at a meeting.
Yeah, it was like secret.
A major compromise between and within political parties at that time was the Hyde Amendment.
Sure.
On public funding for abortions, a kind of a truce among the various parties. Can you explain it and its relationship to what became the Stupak Amendment?
Sure. Henry Hyde Amendment is really the Jim Oberstar Amendment, but we won't go into that.
Okay.
Okay, the Hyde Amendment was about 1976, and every year since then, you're always either part of the main appropriation bills. Hyde Amendment says during the appropriation process, you cannot allocate any funds that would promote, encourage, or pay for abortions. It always lasted for 1 year.
Yeah.
Okay. So every year you have to renew the amendment. Sometimes it was made part of the main bill. Other times it was an amendment on the floor. You'd have your 20-minute argument and you all vote and whatever, however the chips fell, that's whether or not Hyde would pass.
All right.
So it had been around for 30-some years. So despite all of our warnings telling the leadership, Democratic leadership, leave abortion out of health care because they'll destroy the bill, they wouldn't listen. Of course, came through our committee. Lois Capps brings her amendment to pay for abortions. We counter with the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. We win the amendment, then through parliamentary procedures, we lose the amendment a little bit later in the night. And then it became the Stupak Amendment when we had to go to the floor because I was the majority Democrat on the committee and Right to Life Democrat and head of the Right to Life bipartisan Right to Life Caucus. So we held the amendment out and said, no bill will come to the floor unless we get this amendment. And Pelosi kept saying, no amendments, no amendments, no amendments. Pelosi realized she could not.
She didn't have the votes.
She didn't have the votes. You have to have a rule to bring a bill to the floor. There's 435 of us. If we all get to talk and shout at the same time, it's greater chaos than what you see on TV. Mm-hmm. So you have a rule. Rule says, here's the bill you're going to bring up. These are the amendments that will be considered and how much time you have for each amendment. Well, Pelosi's rule was, bill's coming up, one bill, one vote, that's it. And I said, you're not going to vote on it unless we get our amendment. We have a right. Even if we lose it, we have the right to have this vote. And it's been this way for 30-some years. You're not going to deny us. She denied us, and finally, she was forced in November to give me my one amendment, and that was the Stupak Amendment. Even though we had an agreement the night before and had it all worked out, and then she reneged later that night because the pro-choice people wouldn't go along with it.
And the result?
Let me take a moment right here first to remind our viewers, and especially our radio listeners, that we're talking about the Stupak-Pitts Amendment and passage of the health care law with Upper Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak, with me on the panel, Great Lakes Radio News Director Walt Lindela. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Walt.
As you held to your beliefs and your faith with the pro-life stance that you always had,
right.
You know, anybody that knew your career knew you had it. You held on to that, but that resulted in a lot of pressure from the party, the establishment, the leadership, because everybody basically was pro-choice from the president on down that
right.
had the power.
But not when you took office. I think most of the Democrats in the UP were pro-life, right, at one time?
In the state house, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. State house. I was the only one in from Congress.
Okay.
So with that, there was some conversations that said that some of the pressure that you felt from this was a factor in you saying you weren't going to run anymore, which
sure.
kind of popped up, you know, and was that a factor?
It was a factor only to reinforce the decision I'd already made. When President Barack Obama was elected, he went to Grant Park to make his speech. accept the, you know, the nomination. He won, not the nomination, he won the general election. That night at Grant Park, he made his famous speech. I leaned over to Lori and we were just popping the champagne. I said, that's it, I've run my last race, I'm done. I said, we're gonna pass health care and it'll be done. And she said, didn't really believe me, but but I made that promise. And then when they threw John Dingell out a month later, he was chairman of the Energy and Commerce, yeah. Longest serving member, great legislative credentials, who would have had a bipartisan bill and replaced him with Henry Waxman, who got on a, it's this, or not. And if Republicans didn't go along, he just wrote them because he had the votes. There wasn't that give and take. There wasn't that working towards a bipartisan solution to health care.
And I understand that the new speaker, Pelosi, was, you know, really couldn't control Dingell, but she could control Waxman, and she could control the process to ease Dingell out, right?
Correct, and she did. Yeah. She controlled the process to ease Dingell out. Not ease Dingell out, she threw him out like a dog. And I was sort of bitter about that. Mm-hmm. And a number of other things that happened, too. So it just reinforced the decision I already made. So when all the missiles were coming at me from both sides, and they, you know, threatened my campaign and money, and I really didn't care. I had already made up my mind. I wasn't worried about it. I just went through the process and got the job done.
More important
pass health care for all Americans and protect the sanctity of life as opposed to my next election.
What was it like for you to start going back into that after a few years to put it all together and write the stories in the book that you talk about with these attacks when they basically put the boots to you? What was it like to do this?
It was hard, but in a way maybe it was good to get it off your chest. Yeah. You know, like no one knew that the IRS came and investigated me, my campaign. I'm probably the only member of Congress. And when I asked the guy, why me, he said, you know why. And he told me that repeatedly. When the Democratic Party drove all the consultants away from my campaign who had worked with me for years, you knew why. The way they stripped things from me and, you know, they were trying to make me buckle. They were trying to get me to withdraw my position. They tried to do an end run around me with the executive order with the Right to Life Democrats who just said, no, this is not going anywhere without Bart Stupak because he knows it, he lived it. We're following him. So they tried to destroy me, and it was probably good to write about it, mm-hmm. but it's things people didn't know, and some people say, why would you put that in the book? Because it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the unvarnished truth. You know, I've always been a straight shooter. I'm not going to start sugarcoating things now.
You had some allies in all of this, a group of pro-life Democrats that were, for a while, they were called the Stupak 12, and I think they came down to 6, is that right?
A good day.
Toward the end. what were they like? You'd worked with Right to Life, the Conference of Catholic Bishops, pro-life lawmakers, but from your book, the deciding vote came down to that small group of Democrats.
Sure, because by then, Right to Life, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which they used the Stupak to amendment to pass health care in the House, and now that we're in the final chance to pass it, now they want me to use the Stupak amendment to kill the health care bill. So they flipped. And when we would not go along with the idea of using the Stupak amendment to kill health care, they turned on us. I mean, in the book, if you're so concerned about protecting the sanctity of life, we call the Catholic bishops. And I had 6 guys there. They said, we'd call them. I called the guy at home, had his number, or had the lobbyist. So here it is. Here's the exit. Please look it over. Tell us, are we missing anything? We've done everything we could to protect the sanctity of life, but you know, maybe we're missing something. Would you just look at it? Won't even look at it. We're against it. It's not acceptable. We want statutory language or nothing.
They want the Hyde Amendment built into the bill.
Right, yeah. Legislatively. So you don't have to go back every year at the appropriation process anymore. Mm-hmm. It becomes permanent law. The truce was it would never become permanent law. We'd do it every year. And we sort of broke the truce with the Stupak Amendment because that's the only way we could do it. And so Right to Life and all those groups turned on us. So these 6, it was 12. By the time we got to March 21st, 2010, there were about 6 of us, 7 of us actually, counting me. So you got to give those folks credit. What were they like? They're Midwest Catholics, Midwest legislators who were true to word, true to their faith, true to their commitments.
They must have been very loyal to you, I think.
They were, but you build those relations over the years, you know, and I was always the lead Democrat on Right to Life issues in the Congress, and they trusted my judgment on it, and I also protected their integrity without disclosing who they were. I mean, you could figure it out.
That was very interesting, too, to note that you really kept those names secret.
Well, even from my own staff. Yeah. And I personally did a one-on, I was a one-man whip team. I went and personally talked to people to get their commitments. They had to do two things. Number one, vote against the rule if the Stupak Amendment was not made in order. Mm-hmm. If the Stupak Amendment was made in order, then you had to switch and vote for the rule and the Stupak Amendment. And the pro-choice people laughed at us and said, we'll kill you on the floor. We'll wipe you out on the floor. They were shocked when 64 Democrats.
You won by 11 votes.
Yeah, more than that even. More than that. It was 240-some.
Okay.
Yeah, we won big, and they were shocked. Yeah.
The one thing I want to get in before we close the program, a moving section of the book mentions former long-serving Wisconsin Congressman David Obey's late sister. Obey was 40 years in Congress, at least more than that. Could you tell us briefly about her plight and what the law might have meant for her family?
Sure. David and I are close, northern Wisconsin districts are together, adjacent to each other, I should say. David always tells a story. His sister, much younger than him, young mother, mother, married husband, had cancer, went saw her in the hospital in D.C. And she says to him, David, I hope I die by Friday. And he says to her, well, that's a hell of a thing to say. And he says, no, David, I'm not going to leave the husband, my husband, my kids with all these bills because my insurance runs out Thursday. I hope I die by Friday. She died Thursday. And David made a promise that he would do everything he could while he was in Congress to get health care for all Americans. And David, as chairman of appropriations, moved money to Medicare, Medicaid, tried everything to get it, but we never could get the average citizen covered. Not only does an illness like that devastate you physically, it bankrupts you financially. As you said earlier, 62% of all bankruptcies in 2007, and 78% of those people had insurance. That's how much these things will kill you, physically and financially.
It's an era of continued divisiveness within and between parties today. In your judgment, would the Affordable Care Act have passed in today's political arena?
No. There's no middle anymore. Both parties are ideologically way out there on the right and to the left. When I left in 2010, I can't believe all the other so-called moderate Democrats like myself, like a John Tanner, a Bart Gordon, David Obey. Obey was considered a liberal, but had some good solid credentials to work with. A lot of us retired, just had it. We sort of lost faith in our own party, if you will. I mean, it just was no longer the Congress we came in, and we were just sort of tired of this extreme views. Could see nothing getting done.
I'm afraid that's all the time we've got. We've been talking about the book For All Americans by Upper Michigan Congressman, former Upper Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak, about the Stupak-Pitts Amendment and passage of the health care law. Joining us on the panel, Great Lakes Radio News Director Walt Lindela. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on MediaMeet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.